Good morning, everybody. I am Russ Wiegand, the not Pastor Russ, contrary to slip of the tongue you might have heard last week and a little wishful thinking by Katie. But if you've been getting the New Day Minute for a while, which if you aren't, you can sign up on the back of your program to get that email newsletter. But if you've been getting that for a while, you might remember seeing a couple of notes from me back in February. The first of those was kind of an explanation of why in the world I ended up 5,000 kilometers from where I was supposed to be, which was in Nigeria, and I was in Kenya. Give you an idea, if you had asked me a year ago, like what countries would you think about going to do international missions work in, I probably could have thought for a while, come up with two or three options. I doubt that any of them would have been in Africa. I don't have any connections to Africa. I don't have a particular calling to go to Africa for any reason. So I was as surprised as my wife and everybody else when I kind of literally got a tap on the shoulder and said, "You're going to go to Nigeria with Kurt for 3 weeks." Okay. Oh, come on. Don't rotate. iPad's not being cooperative. Sorry. So Pastor Aaron's already told you some of the highlights from that Nigeria trip, right? But the short version is that the only thing that was consistent about the trip was how much the schedule changed. We went into it with an idea of what was going to happen and flipped that an hour into the trip. So part of the constantly turning over schedule was that Kurt and I decided to venture to Kenya since we found that there was an opportunity there and we were basically in the neighborhood. On the scale of international travel, we were right next door. But to give you an idea, that 5,000 kilometers from Nigeria to Kenya is roughly the same as if you were intending to spend the week in Bangor, Maine, and you ended up in San Diego. But from here to there, not such a big deal. So the second note that I had in the New Day Minute was pretty brief and probably a little cryptic if you didn't have any of the background of what was going on. It was real short. But it started out like this. When I was preparing to go to Africa, someone important told me that while she did not know what I would encounter, she knew I would be broken. It seems pretty straightforward, but you know, most of us have heard about people being broken for God. We have a vague idea in our head of what that means. You know, Aaron just recently finished a series on Kingdom Vision, where the graphic that we had up on the screen was God's unbreakable power revealed in broken people. I should have that memorized by now. But understanding what broken really means takes some effort, and my own definition changed while I was in Africa. So I brought some visual aids, because I like visual aids, and I'm going to talk about a couple of different ideas behind broken. I went and scavenged in the shed to see what I could find that was broken. Most of you probably don't recognize this. It's just a dead computer power supply. And I have so many of these in the pile that I don't actually know why this one's broken. I just know that it doesn't work anymore. There's two possibilities. Either the pixies are stuck inside of it, or somebody let the smoke out. And if you know anything about electronics, once you let the smoke out, it's really hard to put it back in. So broken can mean just defective, right? Another possibility for broken can be disassembled. Our stage here gets broken down every week. Doesn't mean anything here gets damaged, hopefully, but it just means that we take all the parts and pieces of our stage, take them apart, put them in storage, take them on a trailer so we can bring them back next week. So broken can be simply disassembled. We can talk about a type of broken that isn't visible. We talk about broken hearts or broken trust. I picked up a new book that I've been reading that I've retitled The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Book a Title I Can Use in Church. Some of you might know which one I'm talking about. But the author uses this description of broken trust. It says, trust is like a china plate. If you break it once with some care and attention, you can put it back together again. But if you break it again, it splits into even more pieces, and it takes far longer to piece it together again. If you break it more and more times, eventually it shatters to the point where it's impossible to restore. There are too many broken pieces and too much dust. While this uses a physical analogy, it's important to remember that broken is not always visible. If the person in the next row to you this morning has a broken heart, you can't see that as obviously as if they had a broken arm. Another example here, I've got this jar. It looks fine, but this jar is broken. It's got a chip in the lid, so it no longer seals. If you put a lid on this and tip it over, it leaks. So it's physically damaged. It's not able to fulfill its original purpose. Now it's really broken. But is it any more broken than it was? If you take something that's broken and you break it again, it's still broken, right? It doesn't change what it is. I think we're getting a little bit closer to what God means by broken, but at the same time, we're getting a little distracted by stuff. Because it's easy for God to send us down a path, and it's usually a pretty narrow path, and we can be walking down this path, and we go, ooh, shiny. We get distracted, right? But as we can see from the remains of my jar here, broken can mean destroyed, too. But I don't think God means for us to be completely crushed and destroyed. So we must be missing something in the word broken. I got some clarity on broken recently when I was helping my daughter clean her room, which is always an adventure. But most days I think her creativity is limitless. It doesn't matter if she's singing a song that she just wrote, painting, writing another book, because I lost track of how many books she's put together and written now, or if she's explaining the rules to a game that she just made up 5 minutes ago. She's always creating something, often physically building something out of Kinex or Lego. But one of her issues with building is that once she's mastered her Lego creation, it has to stay intact. It's going to live on the table or on the chair or on the shelf or somewhere for a very long time. But while I was helping her clean, I convinced her to let me take some of these apart so that the Lego bricks can go back in the bin, right? And I think she's starting to get it, because after a pause, she said, okay, we can always build it again. You know, that understanding that this can be broken down and put together again. And Lego bricks are pretty amazing things. You can build anything you can think of. You know, I saw where somebody built a house that you could actually live in. It had running water in the bathroom and everything. I think it was about 800 square feet. Almost as big as my apartment in college. And there were three of us in that. But suppose you want to build a life-size X-Wing fighter, because who doesn't want a life-size X-Wing in their living room, right? That's been done. You need about 5 million Lego bricks to do it, to fully replicate a full-size X-Wing. But suppose once you finish that, you put in every detail. This is a perfectly recreated X-Wing. The boss comes to you and says, well, that's awesome and all, but what we actually need is a bridge. We have a plan here for a scale model of the Tower Bridge in London. It's 42 feet tall. You got about 800,000 bricks left in your bucket, but the plans call for 5.8 million bricks to build this bridge, which, by the way, has also been done. So we know where the 5 million bricks are, right? They're in this gorgeous X-Wing that we've got sitting over here. We spent countless hours perfecting this X-Wing design, but we don't need it. We need a bridge. So the first thing we have to do is break apart that X-Wing. We're not talking about ripping off a wing or pulling off a stabilizer. It has to be completely taken apart. All of the bricks have to be broken down. Once that's done, we can build something greater out of the pieces. And I think this is closer to what it means for us to be broken for God. We can spend all of our time and energy building ourselves up to be the perfect salesman, the perfect engineer, the perfect artist. But if that's not the role that God has for us, then maybe we need to be broken down and rebuilt into something else. So a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I were sitting in Mass, because we still visit the Catholic Church on occasion to spend time with family. And the priest was talking about, it was Palm Sunday, so he was talking about victory through sacrifice. And then later on Good Friday, he was talking about sacrifice again and defined it as, sacrifice means to make something holy by giving it away in love. Obviously, in the lead up to Resurrection Sunday, he's talking about the sacrifice of Jesus, the perfect sacrifice of his life for all of us. We're all given an opportunity to sacrifice for God's kingdom. For most of us, that doesn't mean literally giving our lives and dying for our faith. Granted, for some of the folks that we met in Nigeria, that's a much more real possibility than it is for most of us. But what if instead we sacrifice those things that limit our ability to grow closer to God, letting him break away those aspects of our lives that get in the way of being rebuilt for his purposes? What if we think about holy pride or holy addiction, if those are things that we give away in love? Those are mine, but I'm sure you can find your own. At first, it seems a little shallow, this idea of, quote unquote, sacrificing something that has no value. But giving these things away leaves as much of a hole and causes as much pain as giving away physical possessions or money for many of us. David talks a little bit about sacrifice in Psalm 51. This psalm is attributed to the time that David was confronted by Nathan after his adulterous affair with Bathsheba. Starting in verse 8, David says, "Oh, give me back my joy again. You have broken me. Now let me rejoice." God helps us to see our flaws by breaking off what doesn't belong and showing it to us. When he breaks us and shows us our sins and our flaws, we have to set aside the pain and the embarrassment that comes from that and rejoice that he has removed it for us. Verse 10 says, "Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a loyal spirit within me." When we sacrifice our vices, God renews us and fills in the hole with his love. Well, in verses 15 and 16, which you'll find on the back of your program, "You do not desire a sacrifice." And here David speaking of the typical animal or grain offering, "or I would offer one. You do not want a burnt offering. The sacrifice you desire is a broken spirit. You will not reject a broken and repentant heart, O God." God's desire is not for us to give him stuff because the rules and the law say we're supposed to give him stuff. You know, you do this, this is the cost, this is what you give to God. He doesn't want us to just give him stuff because the law says to give him stuff, right? His desire is for us to recognize our own flaws, let him break them off of us, and then give him what's left of our broken spirit to be healed. My personal brokenness in Africa started pretty early in the trip when I noticed that there was, we noticed that there was a spirit of pride at play in the conflicts and the difficulties that we were having, getting in the way about sharing with DMM, Disciple Making Movements, which is what we were there for. Looking around at everyone involved, it was pretty easy to identify a couple of individuals where pride was playing a role and getting in the way, in different roles. And there was one spot that I found pride that surprised me. And it shouldn't have, because it should have been the first place I looked. Because I found pride in the mirror. And my pride was getting in the way of myself, getting in the way of doing God's work. Instead of offering myself fully for God to use as he saw fit, I was focused on figuring out what my purpose was. What was my role? Focusing on myself instead of doing God's will. I was fixated on what God wants me to do. And instead of paying attention to what the impact would be on my family when I leave the country for 3 weeks, I was stuck right here thinking about me instead of the people that I was leaving at home. Recognizing that pride in myself was painful, but I held it out to God and let him break it off for love. I wanted God to love me more and use me for his purposes there. And I had to get myself and my pride out of the way. Just as important as that, I love my wife. And my pride nearly destroyed our marriage. It turns out that being 6,000 miles away from home is a great tool for teaching you that you suck at communication. Thankfully, she did a great job of finding us some new tools to put in our toolbox, and our marriage now is stronger than it has been in a very long time. But that's a separate story. But as a result of identifying that pride in myself, I turned to God in prayer. And I think this is the first time that I literally hit my knees in prayer. And I'm not talking about the sit, stand, kneel kind of kneeling that I grew up with. I'm talking about the down on my knees, I don't know what I'm going to do on my own, dumping everything at God's feet and saying, I don't know what to do. This was literally pouring out my fears, my failings, my tears, my confusion, and asking His Spirit to come in and guide me. This ended up being one of the turning points for how I viewed this whole trip. I say one of the turning points because it's not like there was a single turning point where everything changed. It was more like we were going in a spiral and switchbacks. Things were changing all the time, and I kept learning every day. But prayer became one of the central ways that I interpreted the ebbs and flows of the whole journey. When we got together with the Maasai in Kenya, that was where Kurt and I went when we went over to Kenya. We flew into Nairobi and then drove out into Maasai land. We were there to teach them very briefly about what DMM was. We didn't have time to even get started on a full training, but we had an opportunity to introduce them to Samuel, who lives much, much closer than we do. He's a few hours away by bus. So we wanted to make this connection, say, here's what DMM is, and here's the instructor that we're hoping to bring to you to teach him more completely. Excuse me. But when we got together with the Maasai, it wasn't just sitting in a classroom and teaching. We spent probably more time in prayer and in worship and in fellowship than we did in quote-unquote training. We would get together with them in the morning in their church, and we would sing worship together. Somebody would open us in prayer. We would teach, and then we would take a break. We would share tea. It's a common African tradition to serve tea to your guests. So everybody would have tea together. And that was time for fellowship. You know, that was time for everybody to visit, to turn over what they're learning, to learn more about each other. That was at least as important as the time that we spent teaching. We got to share meals with them and got to know some of them personally. As we got later in the week, we started figuring out, okay, we're going to do this three-day training. And we were 45 minutes out of town. So we were staying in a decent hotel. We're pretty sure the directions are basically flying to Nairobi, drive to the last town that still has a hotel. And this is a $15 a night hotel. Until they find out you're white, then it's $40 a night. But this is a $15 a night hotel, which most of the time has running water. It didn't have hot water while we were there, but it had running water most of the time we were there. And we drove about 45 minutes out into the countryside to visit this church. And to give you an idea of the village that we're dealing mostly with farmers and herders. The church is a metal pole building about half the size of the one that I have at my house to store all my junk, because we're Americans, we have too much stuff. But this church was just as important to them as our church is to us. This building, I should say. Their church was wherever they were, just like us. We go out into the community, we're still our church. When they're in their villages, they're still their church. But this building gives them a place to come together and worship corporately, to share in prayer and song. And they welcomed us in there. They put us in the seats of honor because they recognized that we had something to bring them from God. And they honored us for that. They brought us into their home and fed us meals. We ate meals every day there in the pastor's house. But as we were wrapping up what that three-day training was going to look like, we started thinking, well, we're going to have a day left before we fly home. And our host, turns out his sister works at one of the big game preserves in Masai Mara. So I was like, I can get you guys into a safari for free. Flew 8,000 miles from home. I might as well go see some animals in Africa, right? Well, we thought about that, and it's like, yeah, we can do that as long as there's no ministry left to be done. That was the way we couched it early in the week. And as we started figuring out okay, it's not going to cost us anything to do the safari, but it's 3 hours away. What's it going to take to transport six of us down there and back? And about that same time, our host got contacted by another Maasai village that's even more remote than the one we've been spending days at. They had heard through the grapevine that we were in town and wanted to know when they were going to come out there and do training. It's like, you're 2.5 hours away. We don't even have time to get out there and do an intro, right? But then the discussion turned into, well, what if we don't do this safari? What if we take this time that God's given us to go talk to this other village? Well, it's 2.5 hours out, so we don't have time to get out there, do the training, and come back. So they offered to let us stay out there. The way I described this in that New Day Minute message that I said was pretty cryptic was, drive until you leave civilization, keep going until the pavement ends, follow the dirt road until it becomes tracks in a field, keep going until the sheep path peters out, and then get out and walk until you hear them singing praises to God. People joke that my wife and I live far enough out in the country that you have to drive to the other side of Alaska to get there. The drive out to this village makes my gravel road look like an interstate. We drove on a dirt road that would have been bumpy in my four-wheel drive truck, and we were in a Ford Taurus station wagon. We ran out a road, we switched to tractor tracks through a field till we got to a fence line. We followed the sheep path along the fence line till we got to a house. There's nowhere else to go. We parked in the yard. That was the pastor's house. And they invited us in for tea and a meal. And about 10 o'clock at night, we went back outside. And imagine the stars that you can see outside here tenfold. Even as far out as I am in the country, it's dark. I can see a lot of stars. I could see way more out in the middle of nowhere in Kenya. But we could hear people singing. And so we took our flashlights and we made our way across the pasture following the sound, because these people were singing praises to God at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, because chores are done, it's time to go to church. And we went, we gave them a 5-minute, here's what DMM is, here's Samuel, he's hopefully going to come back and teach you guys. And we sang with them, we prayed with them, and we went back and we stayed at the pastor's house. They all left. They gave us their beds, said, you can sleep here, you sleep here, you sleep here, and they all left. I have no idea where the whole family stayed, because they gave up their beds for us. But we got up in the morning, and they brought in charcoal braziers to keep us warm, because it's a dirt floor concrete house. There's no central heat. It's 50 degrees when you wake up in the morning. So they brought us heat, they heated up water, they made us tea, made us feel welcome. And then we made our way to the next church. And we've got a picture of this church that I want to share. Again, a very simple metal building. There's actually two buildings in this picture. The blue roof in the background is their church. And this silver building is newer. It's only about 2 years old. That was this two-room schoolhouse that they built. Because the families that attend this church, their kids don't go to school until they built this. So they could teach their kids, you know, the basics, reading, math, hopefully get them the opportunity to go to school later. But what I learned at this church in the morning is that people desire prayer. We went in, we started very similar to the church the night before. We spent some time in worship. And we spent some time in prayer. And the pastor got up and started talking, and all of this is going on through interpreters, because nobody speaks each other's languages except for a couple of people, and we've got Maasai, Swahili, and English all. It's interesting when you're listening to somebody talk and you're listening to the translator and you're not understanding either one of them because they're bouncing between Maasai and Swahili. But we started getting this story from the pastor. As soon as she found out that we were going to come visit, which was like 24 hours earlier, there was one person that she wanted to make sure made it to this church service. And that was this little boy. And as she's talking, mom brings this boy up. She's got a 3-year-old that she's carrying. This little 3-year-old has macrocephaly and severely underdeveloped legs. So he's 3 years old and he doesn't walk. He can't run and play with his friends. You know, we've got our 3-year-olds down the hall. We can't keep up with them. And his mom's holding this boy because he can't walk. And the pastor's explaining that she wanted this boy there so that we could pray for him. Who am I? Right? Why does she think that I have any more power of prayer than she does? But these people have a faith and a desire for prayer. They understand that you bring these prayers honestly and purely to God, and He will answer them. After we prayed for this little boy for several minutes, his mom picked him up. Well, she had set him down, and he was kind of leaning against her legs, and he's just kind of sinking into the floor as she lets go of him. So we're kind of holding him up as we're praying for him. And she takes him and sits back down, and the pastor invites everyone else that needs prayer to come up. And we had 6 or 7 people come up that just came up and knelt because they needed prayer. And as we're praying and the people are praying and singing, they're crying and their tears are literally pooling on the floor. You know, after we were done praying, these people went back to their seats. There's tear stains on the floor of this church. But then they brought us back up in front because they wanted to pray for us. It wasn't that they thought that we had any more power of prayer than they did. It was just that they recognized that we can pray to God for them. They can pray to God for us. So they prayed for us. They blessed our mission. They blessed our travel. These beads were gifts from them that they brought up as a reminder of their prayers for us. But as we're up there and the people are singing and praying and coming up and tying beads around all of our necks, the back of the church, there's a little 3-year-old boy. I watched that boy walk from the back door up to the seats where people were singing. And then I understood what it means when God breaks you. A few weeks ago, my family and I went over to Green Bay to see a Mercy Me concert. And along with great music, one of the things that Bart, the lead singer in Mercy Me, said is that religion says get it right, and grace says I'll be there when you get it wrong. We spend so much of our time and effort trying to get it right, and not enough time asking God if it's even the right it that we're getting right. The opening acts for Mercy Me were Crowder, hence the shirt. And if you want to hear my daughter break into song, just walk up to her and say, "Wildfire," in the lowest voice you can manage, and she'll sing the whole song to you. But the first opener was Micah Tyler. And Micah Tyler opened up the show along with Micah Tyler, Micah Tyler, and Micah Tyler, which was pretty cool to see. He opened up with himself in triplicate. But we're going to take some time for reflection here. We're going to listen to his song, "Different." Because this song talks about looking at yourself in the mirror and changing who you are. So let's take some time, listen to it, and see if God has something to break for each of us today.